You're listening to Auto D, coming at you live.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for tuning in to the Auto D Show here on Dave Pratt's Star Worldwide Networks, broadcasting from high above Camelback Road in beautiful Scottsdale, Arizona, where it's already dark out. I thought it was still the middle of summer, but today's the first day of fall, and it's like dark out already. It's crazy. Anyway, I am your host, Otto Daniolo, and this evening my guest is the singer-songwriter Matthew Thornton of a band called Vinyl Station. And Matthew and I will be having a chat right after this first song tonight from the Fervor Records catalog called In the Deep by the Mail Order Brides here on the Otto D Show. Check it out.
Listening to Auto D, coming at you live.
And that was In the Deep by the Mail Order Brides here on the Auto D Show, which is brought to you by my good friends at Fervor Records and TheRecordingArtist.com, where you can participate in my live recording sessions with all kinds of bands. Layer by layer, you'll see their songs come together in a two-hour-long webcast recording session. So if you ever wondered what that world's like, then join us at TheRecordingArtist.com and check it out.
To do that.
Without further ado, I'm going to turn on my guest's microphone. Don't you know how these interviews work? You can't come on until I say...
Fair enough.
Okay, let's pick.
I got all excited.
We're going to back up. And now, without further delay, let me bring tonight's guest, Matthew Thornton, on. Matthew, how are you doing?
I could be worse. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, well...
welcome
to the show.
I'm amazing. I feel great. I'm happy to be here. And that song was good by the
Mail Order Brides.
Mail Order Brides, which is a cool name.
Isn't that a great name?
Yes, it is. I'm always jealous of cool band names.
Isn't it one of the hardest things when you get a bunch of mates together and you try to name a band?
It's the worst thing. The criterion that we go on is if you settle on a name and if you all don't hate it in 4 months, then you can keep it. So that's what we did, and we didn't hate it. One of the band members eventually did hate it, but he.
So you kicked him out.
He did. He eventually left on his own. Okay. And we're still very good friends, which was like the best way to break up a band. Like he, you know, was like very nice and everything.
First of all, what's the band name we're talking about?
Band name was Vinyl Station.
Okay. And Superstars.
I'm the only one that's still in it from when it was named.
Okay.
So it was a old drummer and I came up with the name, then added bass player, and then he left, and then we got another one. So it's been a revolving door of extremely talented, gorgeous people, but I'm the only one left.
The only original member.
Yes.
Cool. When did you come up with the name? How long ago was that?
I think about 11 or 12 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And we have been wildly unproductive.
Wildly unproductive? Since.
Well, yeah, we don't record.
Well, this year's been difficult.
We don't like record or tour much or do as much as we should because we're sort of busy making a living.
Right.
And then we've had a few scares of like, okay, we get on a good tour and we did that for a while, and that was like in 2015 was the last time we did that.
What big tour?
Rob Thomas. We were opening for him for a long time.
I've heard of him.
He's the greatest guy in the universe.
Was
he's
cool?
He's super nice.
Isn't it fun when you find out that they're cool?
Oh my God. Like, however he seems, he's like that, except I think he's funnier in person than he can be in interviews. He's just very nice and sweet, you know?
Right.
But he's got a sort of a dark wit about him as well, which I like because I'm kind of like that. But it was really fun, and then you're playing for much bigger crowds than you've ever played for, and people are listening, and people are lining up to have you sign CDs and stuff at the end, and
because they're kind of discovering you,
yeah,
come to hear him,
we were able to turn some people into fans very quickly.
Yeah.
And you don't have very long. Usually you have about 10 seconds before somebody just gets out their phone or whatever. So you have to really...
And says, honey, I got time to get one more drink before Rob Thomas
I'm
going to
go
on.
Get a snow cone or whatever. I don't know what the people do. But like, you don't have very long. And we were able to keep people interested. We got a couple of standing over. You can delete that in post, but
I can.
We
can delete that in post.
The reason that I said I is because it's on my bucket list to get a standing ovation at the Ryman Auditorium in Tennessee.
Cool.
Got one.
Awesome.
So we got one. But anyway, so we had some really amazing moments. And then you feel like you're getting some snowball effect or whatever it is that you want to try to get and some things. And then then we got a label deal out of that. And the label was some sort of way.
Okay.
They had their own ideas,
what
I suppose.
What was the label?
I don't want to get into it. That's kind of their job. I don't want to talk shit about anybody. They didn't know how to break a band. They still don't. And I love them, and they'll always be there, I suppose.
Well, when you were on that tour, you know, and you were doing those gigs for those audiences, did you have the sense of, this isn't the end of the road, this isn't the high point, this is like, oh, finally, we're on the ladder, I can't wait for the next step, when it's our turn. You feel like you're still going up.
Yeah, what was exciting about it was that we felt like we could do it.
Mm-hmm.
If you know
so
what I mean.
So kind of like, affirmation like, of, oh, we do belong.
Yeah,
we can
hang in a theater and it's not boring and we have enough happening that it's not super simplistic and it's not boring people.
Mm-hmm.
They're not having to listen to it 50 times to get into the song. You can hear one of the songs and just, you know, it's accessible enough. I try not to write pop songs. I just want to write songs that I like.
Mm-hmm.
But I like a lot of pop songs. Like, I like a bunch of Coldplay songs and U2 and old U2.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of really accessible music is stuff that I like. So sometimes it comes out that way, but you never know. And so when that was happening, it was nice because it was like, oh, these are we can get these across and people enjoy them.
Mm-hmm.
And when this was, it's a big test because you're walking out on, you know, you've never played in front of more than a couple hundred people. I think we had sold out, not sold out, we sold 350 tickets at one point, and that was the most. And that was like, we were happy.
Claimed, right?
That was like our show, you know. I think it was a Crescent Ballroom.
And then you landed this gig for the tour.
And then, yeah, and then a few months later, we went on tour. And then we, the first night, we played for 2,200 people, I think, in Akron or something. And you you know, there is a weird moment where the lights, the house lights are on and the stage lights are on, like sort of a wash of all the stuff. And it's just everybody's, you know, filing in and mm-hmm. finding their seats, and then the house lights turn off,
right,
and then there people start clapping because something happened, and then we walk out, and by the time we get to the microphone, no one's clapping anymore because they don't know who you are.
Right,
it's not exciting anymore. Somebody walked out, and then there's this moment where, which I love because I've been gigging for so many years, and I love the moment where someone is listening. But they're not convinced. That's where I want you. I love that moment.
Because you like to nail that moment for them. You like to watch them take their medicine.
Yeah, a little bit.
Like I'm going to take you right here. I'm going to take you now. Here we go. Watch this.
I got, and then in a few short, hopefully, quickly, right. I got you.
You can feel it happen.
And then, you sink into this sort of weird flow state together, and you experience another universe outside of the one that you're in, and you don't think about anything else. You're just in the song. And the more people you can do that with, this is why you do it. Because if you've had that experience, you chase it for until you're dead, right? I think.
Yeah.
So that was really fun to take a bunch of expecting faces to just go, because you walk out and they go, oh, yeah. And then
you know where you think you're going to take them. They have no idea where they're going to go.
They're just looking up at the stage like, what do you got?
Yeah.
And then you go, I got something. I'll show you in a second.
Yeah, that's fun.
And to have that sort of playful confidence was really cool. And then to come back to that's not how it's going to go, and you have to sort of start over or rebuild or like waste a bunch of time with a label that doesn't understand you or doesn't understand how to run a business or a label or anything. And then you have to leave that and then go off on your own. And then you don't have any money for recording anymore and blah, blah, blah. It's, you know, we're the first ones to ever go through this.
Oh, not at all. But let's get back to that tour for a second. I think the first time you do something like that, the first time you have that opportunity and experience, there's a lot of life lessons that come to play. You just described, you know, that first time you have that big of an audience that you kind of get to kind of go into that flow with. But then how about, were you at an event where you had that many people, anywhere from 2,000 to 10,000 people, where when the house lights were down, you couldn't see anybody, but you know they're there.
Yeah.
And if you're wearing in-ears, you can't really tell if they're clapping sometimes at the end of the show, at the end of the song.
Right. Either.
So it can be really weird when you can't see them and you can't hear them and you're wondering when the clapping's done or when to talk again. Is that it's a whole new learning of the energy, of the timing.
That was
a
weird thing too, because the first time I ever wore in-ear monitors was that show.
Oh, okay.
And
did you wear them both or pull one out so you could kind of hear what was happening?
I cracked one to kind of hear, but like we were lucky because we had a really good crew and Rob instructed them to take care of us and treat us like family and everything. So that was amazing. He actually cut his first sound check short to make room for us because the management and everything were like, you do not get used to that because, you know, DMX is not going to cut his sound check short or whatever. I don't know. I just threw out the name because I know you recorded him. But like, he was just very accommodating and sweet. And so that was a big lesson though. And we had some stage mics, you know, you couldn't hear very well. Obviously the applause after we would stop were so thunderous that they couldn't be ignored. So
there you go.
That was no big deal.
Well, I just remember doing some theater shows where, you know, you couldn't see anyone.
You can see the first two rows, maybe.
Yeah, maybe.
Right.
And in some of these theaters, they have the first row now, they've got it back about 12 feet because they want people to be able to, you know, 10 people to dance or whatever.
Right,
you know?
That didn't happen.
And I really couldn't see. I've done shows where I couldn't see anyone. Yeah. And then I couldn't hear anything afterwards. And you felt like Star Trek, like you're on a hologram and you're just in this by yourself.
Right. You can see some silhouettes. You can see some silhouettes of people. So you know that they're there, but you can't see any.
Yeah.
Nobody's chair dancing, or if they are, you can't tell.
It's weird.
Obviously, we're not really a
dance band. So how long were you out on that tour with the band?
I think we did 5 months.
Was that the first time you were on the road that long?
We did 67 cities with them, yeah.
So how about
Yeah.
So how about the inner workings of the dynamics of your own band? How did everybody get along on that trip? Was it better?
The band was good before we left, and then a lot better as we were going. Yeah, it was. I think something about traveling too. We were driving a Honda Odyssey with the four of us in it. We couldn't afford a bus or anything, mm-hmm. so we were gift / I think we rented it from her, but my wife's cousin or something had this old van that had like 10,000 miles on it. It did not have that many when we gave it back, but we ran that thing into the ground, and yeah, it was like this baby blue Honda Odyssey that we were all kind of crunched into, and yeah, you get really close with people, and obviously yeah. You're sharing hotel rooms, and we would have a system where we would get the keys from the trucker drivers of their tour. So the truck drivers would show up, they would go sleep during the day and then drive all night to the next city. We would get their old, very sometimes used hotel keys, and we would go crash in their hotel rooms because the checkout was 11 the next morning. So we were like, well, we can go crash for 5-6 hours, then wake up early and drive to the next city and be there by the time we were supposed to load in and soundcheck at 3.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody in the band and everybody, all the crew and everybody would wake up in this new city, go get coffee, the whole thing. And we were like, you know, hungover driving to the next city. And
it's a lot of work, isn't it?
It was fun, though.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would do it again in a heartbeat.
Yeah.
Maybe I would drink less, though.
Maybe.
Probably not. I don't know.
So now, in Vinyl Station, even that version, the original version of the band, were you the only songwriter or the primary songwriter? What was your role?
I write the lyrics and melody. That's my job. I would rely on other people to bring their parts and everything and write hooks and stuff like that. Brennan was really good at finding, he's our old guitar player, he was always really good at finding a hook and writing in that way. But I'm a little bit selfish or territorial with lyrics,
mm-hmm.
in particular.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm a sort of a lyric, if you can't, you know, somebody was listening to recently was talking about lyrics are the entry point for some people. Some people, it's the drums. If it's got a good beat, they can listen and dance. They don't care what the lyrics are. I'm a lyric person first.
Mm-hmm.
If it has bad lyrics, I can't like the song. So I'm sure there might be exceptions to that, but mostly if the lyrics aren't good, then it's not good. And so I kind of, maybe selfishly, but I don't know, I can't hand that the reins over,
mm-hmm.
for that. I'm just too protective. Maybe that's to my detriment, but no. Luckily, nobody's really trying to anyway. It's not like
right.
like Roy, our drummer, is like sneaking me lyrics like, hey, what do you think about this? I think everybody's probably wise to stay in their lanes and bring me drum ideas. I don't need you to tell me how to sing.
That's interesting. You know, my brother is like that. He's one of those, we were always grew up sharing records and sharing music. And we even shared our first guitar, which he didn't play very long. And I bought him out of it right away.
Wow.
Then he kept buying motorcycles while I bought guitars, you know.
Okay.
But one day, he'll send me music to listen to. He lives in Texas. And he sent me this female artist. I can't remember who it was now. It was years ago. And he says to me, you know, followed up with me a week later, hey, what'd you think of that record or that singer? And I had listened to it, and I thought, I don't know that I ever got to the words, because the music was something I didn't think was done really, really well. It didn't seem to make sense to me. It was quirky. I didn't like the sound of her voice. And so before it ever got very far, I wasn't into it. I didn't care what she had to say, because I didn't like the music. So it's kind of the other way around.
Yeah, yeah.
So I started complaining about, well, here's what I didn't like. You know, here's what he's like, yeah, but what about the words? And I said, well, I don't know. I didn't listen to the words. He goes, what else is there? And I'm thinking, oh, you're one of those. All you hear are the words, you know? But he's one of those guys who only, that's all he really hears. His whole relationship to the music is the lyric.
Right.
So I think a lot of your fans are that way. You know, there's a lot of music fans essentially listen to the words.
They have to get into the lyrics.
Yeah.
Oh, there are a lot of people that don't like my songs, I think, because they don't know what they're about. Because I don't write literally, or I don't write story songs, or anything that's necessarily about anything. Or at least that on the first listen where you go like, oh, okay, this is what it's about. It's about this guy who went to the thing, and then he got in a fight, and then he went home. And like those kind of things I'm not interested in. So my stuff is a little like, I like, you know, relating it to a painting or something. I like something with some shapes, maybe some forms or something, but I'm not a literalist where you can see what it is and you know, oh, that's a lady riding a bike or whatever. It's more of like that might be a person or a frog or whatever. Like, and you can read into it a lot more easily that way. And I like lyrics that are like that too, like much more vague. Not nonsensical, but vague.
So do you have people come up to you going, I know exactly what you mean, and you're kind of like, I don't even know what I meant.
Yeah, well, a lot of people ask me, what does that song mean? What does that lyric mean? Or whatever. And I go, I have no idea. It changes from year to year. There are a lot of songs that I had that I thought meant something, and probably did. And then I had kids, and then it meant something else.
Hmm.
And then I had whatever happened, and then it means something else. And so that's some of my favorite stuff happens to be that way, where it changes as you go to kind of fit whatever you need it to fit.
Mm-hmm.
And which is why sometimes I've had this experience with listening to other music, is if I heard this a year ago, it wouldn't have hit me.
Mm-hmm.
But now it does. Like, you know, I'll hear a Wilco record or something, and if I had listened to it right when it came out, it would have gone right over my head, or it just wouldn't have made sense. And then now it's like, oh, now I get it. It's because where I am, or whatever's mm-hmm. happening, or whatever. So that stuff is interesting. But you're also like, I don't know. I think music also, the music has to be good too. There mm-hmm. are a lot of bands that I'll listen to, and I turn it off before I get to the lyrics, because I think the music sucks. So everything has to be pretty good for me to like it. I really don't like almost all music. But then the 2-4% that I like, I'm obsessed with.
It's an interesting thought, because I think I'm probably very similar in that way. People would always ask me, I bet you have a killer sound system at home. And I'm like, I don't listen to music at home. Not even in the car. I have the radio off, because I listen to music all day at work when I was constantly running a recording studio. The last thing I was going to do is listen to music. And what's really weird when you just listen to brand new music all day long, because you're making it,
right?
To hear a record you've already heard, like something from when you were a kid, is like, I don't have time for that. So I couldn't listen to old music at all. I couldn't listen to anything that I had already knew. It's like, if it wasn't something I'd never heard, I didn't want to hear it. And that's a weird place to be.
Yeah.
So I found that I didn't listen to music because most of what I was hearing I didn't like. So I just quit listening to music for a long time.
Right.
Until a friend of mine said, when's the last time you bought a record just for fun? And I said, oh, I don't know.
10 or 12
years ago. Yeah. So I was like, I went and bought a record for fun, you know. But
How was it?
Oh, it was great. But you
got
to find the record. And, you know, certain records have done that to me in my lifetime. I remember when Jagged Little Pill came out.
Yeah.
I was walking through the living room, headed to the garage to get in the car, and it was on MTV. It had come on, and I just stopped in my tracks and looked at the TV, watched the song till it was done so I could see the credit.
Which song was it?
It was the first single.
You ought to know, probably.
Yeah. So I went right to Tower Records and bought the record on my way to where I was going, because it's like, I have to have that. Whatever
it was,
that
something,
is.
Something we had never heard before.
Yeah. And Nirvana was the same thing. First time I heard Teen Spirit, I was like, what?
What is that? These things
are just different enough and dramatic. Had an urgency and the energy that just made you better listen to me. And I'm like, hell yeah, I better listen to you.
Yeah.
This is something. So those things always grabbed me. You know.
That's interesting. Especially as a producer, because I think you, I haven't worked with you a lot, but the time we did have was really fun. We just did the recordingartist.com series and just do one song in one day or whatever. It was really cool, but it was also you are trying to pull out a performance, which is probably what you're expecting from new music.
Yeah, it's like you want to feel something.
You got to give me something.
Yeah, it always boils down to me is like, why did you, are you doing this song? Why did you write this song? I mean, because it doesn't have to just be a pretty melody. If that's why you wrote it, great, right. It's a pretty melody. But typically, there's something behind it. Some element of passion, some element of purpose, picked those words or picked that rhythm or picked that energy. That's the thing sometimes when I feel like if it's missing, it always boils down to trying to get that information from the performer. Because if you can clarify that, I'm going to feel this song.
You told me that, like, try to go back to where, like,
why
where,
you wrote the song.
Why you wrote it or what.
I don't know why I wrote it.
I do not know. I never know.
Yeah, and that can totally be the case, you know. But for a lot of times, I think people just, they're not in touch with that anymore. And right. So when they can, when
they just remember, know the notes and they remember.
Yeah, so when they kind of remember, oh, well, here's what was going on, yeah. Here's what. Yeah, I remember that. And so then if you can get them back there sometimes, you can feel it again. So it's just, I found that to be a common experience with performers. Because we get so comfortable in our comfort zone. We know what we can do. We've done it 1,000 times on stage. So when you've got to do something you've never done, you're reluctant. Certainly in front of an audience, you're generally reluctant because it's not your
I find that spot. I prefer an audience, and I would actually like having somebody that's not in the band or producer in the studio, because I don't it's harder for me to completely play a song without making a connection. So if there's a really good listener in the room, the song is way better for me.
Yeah,
and it doesn't matter how much I concentrate or try to get the notes perfectly or whatever it is. There's something that elevates the song by having somebody listen to it. And I always think the way that I explain that is like the if a tree falls in the woods and nobody hears it, did it happen or whatever, or did it make a sound?
Yeah.
And I think in some ways I can only play or perform about 70% of a song. And somebody's got to meet me in the middle and try to understand it and get into that big hot tub or elevator, and the doors close and the rest of the world is gone and nothing, we're not experiencing anything except that connection of that. That's why I think I write very strangely, because I think of it as like a trance. I'm not in control of it. The idea is the king. And it's going to tell me what it wants, and I need to just kind of do it and then get into that zone with as many people as possible. And when it happens, it's really fun. I don't know if that makes sense. Yeah. That's a bunch of weird.
You sent me a couple songs. I think we should play one of them.
Let's go.
Now, I've never played a song on the show from my phone, so we're going to find out if I know how this day and age to do something like that. So I have a tune here called...
I will take responsibility for that, by the way, because I only sent it about... 5 minutes before we got on.
Okay, this is called I'm going to pause because I think it's already playing. Okay, I paused it 3 seconds and I'll back it up. This is called Why Do You Wait?
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
This was a song that Brendan wrote a lead part for another song that I won't tell you what it is.
Okay.
A song called Midnight by Coldplay. And we used to cover it. And it's this two chord thing. It's kind of like the Rhiannon chords, basically. So they ripped it off anyway.
That's right.
So it's not.
Just
it's
bringing it back.
Right. So it's A minor F, A minor F, A minor F. And then it goes to a C or whatever. So anyway, we would cover this thing. And he didn't know how the song went. He only heard me play it. And he came up with a cool lead line for it. And then we decided that we didn't want to waste that lead line on a cover, so we said, let's write a song around that hook. And then I started playing those chords and came up with this, and then the lead line fit with it perfectly, obviously, because we were stealing it. And and then that it kind of happened, and then yeah, that's it. I just channel it. I don't know what it means. I think it's talking about fear or something like that, but it's a nice one, man. It came out really well.
Why Do You Wait? From Vinyl Station and Matthew Thornton here on the Otto D Show. Check it out. He says as he hits play on his phone and it's playing, does it start really quiet? Where's my volume down all the way on my phone?
Oh, there it goes.
Now let's see if I can start.
Yeah.
Let's start.
No, it's fine.
Oh, too late.
You didn't miss anything.
We got it. We got this. Check it out.
It's a slow burn. Cure
That's Why Do You Wait here on the Auto D Show from Vinyl Station, where my guest is Matthew Thornton, the singer and songwriter of that track.
Technically, yes.
Technically, yes.
Literally, yes. Yeah, I did write that song. I love that one.
It's a nice track.
I haven't listened to it in a while, and it's a sort of a slow build, but it gets me all riled up at the end, doesn't mm-hmm. it?
That's cool. Yeah, it gets nice kind of great. A little bit of chaos going on.
Chaos.
So let's talk a little bit about how you got started. I mean, was Vinyl Station your first band?
No, but I'm not going to tell you about the other ones because the names were so stupid.
Great. Let's leapfrog over that.
Five or six in college where trying to figure ourselves out, I suppose.
Oh, yeah. But speaking of college, you went to one.
I went for a year.
Not just to play a gig.
I went for a year and a half and I got kicked out.
Okay, what school?
They called you. And they said, so this isn't working.
this isn't working out for us.
And I was like, are you breaking up with me? And they said, yeah, it's you can't come back. And so I lived in the dorms for another 6 months. For a semester when I wasn't attending.
Right.
And the people didn't know because I don't think they tell the RA.
Right.
Like, hey, so-and-so is not allowed to stay in the, you know. So I would just crash on couches and rooms, and I was very friendly. I was a terrible student, but I wasn't a jerk or anything. And so I would, all the staff knew me really well. I was always nice to them, so they would let me into the kitchen and eat all the stuff. So it was I lived a very weird life. At one point, I was donating blood plasma for ramen money. It has not been an easy road. Unless, maybe it has been. I don't know. I don't have anything to compare it to. But
it's been the only road you've been on, right?
Yeah, I don't know. It's like when somebody asks you what it's like to not be a twin. I don't know. It's fine.
Yeah, exactly. So what school was this?
I went to University of Dallas, actually, for a while.
Okay.
My brother and sister both went there, and I was like, well, I guess that's where you go.
That's where you go when you're from my family. Huh?
And for some reason, so I got like C's and D's in high school. When I got my diploma, right, they give it to you in like a pleather envelope or whatever.
Right.
And everybody opens it up, and they admire it and stuff. And I got mine, and I just wanted something to be in it. Because maybe they didn't want to embarrass me, so they gave me something, but I wasn't graduating because I didn't know. And then I opened it up, and I look at it, and something's there, and it's like, yeah, you did it. And I look up, and my history and chemistry professors, the teachers, were both like, they were mouthing, you're welcome. They both gave me, because I was likable, I think that's the only reason why, because I was nice. Ish, you know, I don't know. Shy little kid. They both gave me D minuses instead of F minuses or whatever I deserved.
Right.
And I graduated. And then I got almost a full ride to college. I don't know what kind of essay I wrote or what. My SAT scores were basically like very medium mm-hmm. to low, mm-hmm. nothing special. And for some reason they thought like, yeah, let's give them a bunch of scholarships and stuff. And then I went, and they were like,
Matthew Thornton.
It just got mixed up in the paperwork. He's all strung out on heroin right now in Seattle or something.
Straight A's in high school.
Fending off. Yeah, they're like,
couldn't get into college.
Right.
That's horrible.
Yeah, I squandered his prospects.
You know, it's funny, when you were talking about college, I kept thinking, it reminds me of mine. And then the whole scholarship thing. It's funny. I did good in grade school. I did good in high school.
Yeah.
But I did good enough. I never had to read a book. So when I went to my first year of college, and they gave you 35 pages in the first class, I haven't read 35 pages in my life. I couldn't get through it without having to reread it 10 times to understand what it was. I had no ability to understand it. So basically, I flunked out too. I had a 0.4 grade point average.
Nice.
0.0.
I had 0.4. I had a 0.6 my final semester. So I went for a year and a half.
Yeah.
And I did a 2.6 and then a 1.6 and then a 0.6.
See, I just went in 0.4 my first year.
And you were like, I'm out. That's that was way smarter. I did, I was the same way though, like with the reading, because I didn't buy any of the books. Mm-hmm. They were really expensive.
Yeah.
And I was like, you guys didn't give me a scholarship for the books, so I'm just not going to get them.
You know, the artist mind is different.
Well, if we would have known then, like, what audio, visual, and kinesthetic meant back then, you would have been like, hey, a couple of you nerds in this class can't read and comprehend it. And I can read. It's fine. Mm-hmm. But we're audio people.
Mm-hmm.
If we hear something, it sticks so much better than reading it.
Yeah.
When I read, I just fall asleep.
Yeah.
But if I can listen to an audiobook for 10 hours and remember everything.
Yeah.
So it's just how you process the world. And so if they had known that back then, and then maybe they did and they were resisting, or they wanted me to fall in or something, which I haven't made a habit of doing what I'm told.
Which is, you know, it's artists, man, I tell you. It's just, there's no way around it. You know,
we're just not going
right.
to go along.
It's not going to happen.
Yeah.
Where's everybody going? Over there? Okay, fine. I'm not going over there. I don't know where I'm going, but I'm not going over there because that's where everybody's going. It's kind of built in that way.
I like that. And I don't know if you can't be proud of something that you had nothing to do with, right? It's like being proud that you're tall. Like I didn't have anything to do with it, but I like being that way. But I also know that when they take over, we're the first against the wall. The people that think differently and won't do what they're told.
Right. That's true.
Yeah.
Wouldn't you want to be?
Yeah, no, I don't want to hang out and be
not,
like...
No, not in that case.
All the suffering and all that. You're going to starve everyone because you're the whole... Just shoot me.
Yeah, exactly.
Try to get my head.
So no, let's get off of that morbid topic. And let's get back to Texas. Were you born in Texas?
I was not. No, I was born in Illinois. I was born in Oak Park, Illinois, outside of Chicago.
I know where that's at. I was born in Peoria, Illinois.
Peoria? Yeah. Okay. A little further out.
Yeah.
Nothing wrong with it.
Nothing wrong with that.
No. So yeah, I grew up there.
So what happened? Family move out when you were young?
No. They stayed. They're still there.
Wow. I
can't believe my parents.
But everybody went to school in Texas?
Yeah. It was like my family was pretty Catholic growing up, so this wasn't, I think it's technically an independent university, but it was very
a Christian school,
sort of Catholic-y, you know. They had a bunch of the curriculum that was sort of geared towards that, and so that's where a lot of people in our sort of circles would go.
Mm-hmm.
There were a few colleges that were sort of acceptable in that way.
Mm-hmm.
And so and I was always I wasn't interested in anything except guitar. I started playing guitar when I was 14 with my brother. I used to play the boxes with wooden spoons, and he would play the guitar, and I would sing backup for him, and we would learn replacement songs.
Mm-hmm.
And like, you know, the first song I ever sang on was Anywhere Is Better Than Here, and I was able to sing the counter melody. So the you know, it'd be like, anywhere's better than here. And I would do the counter melody because it was like something that he couldn't sing. And so my brother would sing and play guitar, and I would do these little boxes in the basement and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved that feeling. I don't know what it was. And then when he went to college, I had to play guitar because I had to be able to keep singing for some reason.
Interesting. So
never really thought about it, but just had to keep singing. And so it's still the only reason I play is so that I can sing. I'm not a guitar player. I'm a pretty bad guitar player. I can play what I can play pretty well so that I can sing, but I never think of myself as a musician, really. I'm just a singer. You know.
Well, back when you first played and your brother went to college, did you form bands, cover bands, and play around Chicago?
No.
So you never got into that circuit?
I think I had five, 10 gigs.
So most of your band work was after school, after college.
Yeah, I met a friend in college that I still write with sometimes, Patrick Birch, and we got along musically like perfectly right away. He just, for some reason, we can just read each other, and we could, it was almost like, remember that scene in the movie Once where they sit down and he plays the piano and she sings along, and it like the first take.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, oh yeah, here are some words and here, just sing the thing, and I would never have believed that that was possible if it didn't happen to me with other musicians. Because I was like, there's no way. She's not going to know the melody. You like, you can't go, like, she's going, no, no, da. And I'm like, yeah, there's, but.
Interesting.
If you've experienced it, you know that that's actually possible. Like, you can have these moments where I start playing a Peter Gabriel song or some song that he's never heard, and he just does what he's supposed to and goes where he's, and you can, and then when you have that, you're like, oh, this is all I want to do. So then I did even less schoolwork.
Well, and what got you out to Arizona?
Actually, that same friend lived here, and he got married very, very young. I think he got married in his sophomore year of college. So he was like, I think he was 20 and his wife was 21. So he couldn't even drink at his own wedding. And I thought that was cool. But also, the weather here, we all came, you know, some of us came out and went to the wedding. And
you're like, wow, people live out here?
70, well, it was 70 degrees. He got married in January.
Right.
I think it was over Christmas break or something. And so we come out and we're like, oh, come on. What is this? And I was freezing. I think it was probably years later, you know, six, eight years later. I don't really remember my life. I haven't been paying attention. But it was much later, and I was in sort of a weird relationship and decided to move. The day that I decided, I was on my way in an old Oldsmobile that had no air conditioning. And I had a couple of speakers, a guitar that was a piece of junk, and a bag of clothes. I was on my way out here. And I don't understand it. And like most of the, I'll kind of decide very cautiously what to say to someone. Just in a normal conversation, I'll pick my words very carefully, you know. And then giant decisions in my life, I just wing it. And I don't understand it. And I just go, like, I guess I'm moving there today. Or I guess I'm getting married in Vegas. And then the wrong woman.
I tell you something to think about, though. Oh, yeah. That's another story we should get into.
Yeah, no, we shouldn't.
But you just said that you carefully choose your words in a conversation.
Sometimes. Not always.
But think about this. Yeah. How many seconds does it take you to choose that word? Because I bet it's about the same amount of time it took you to decide to move to Arizona.
Yeah.
So it's the same process.
That's true.
It's just that in a conversation, that's all the patience you have, and it's enough.
Yeah, it's a...
But in the big life decisions, that's still all the patience you have, and it's not
4,000th of a second in either case. Right. But one of them is going to impact... Like, here's the thing. I always think about... There's a Martin Sexton song that if he hadn't written that song, there are four people that would not exist. Because I met my wife at a Martin Sexton concert. And there are these little, tiny little ideas or things or whatever that can change lives. And I've never met him, but if I met him, I would tell him, the only reason that my kids exist is that you wrote that one song, because that's the only reason I went to that show. Some of my friends were going, they're like, oh, he's great live. And I was like, nah, whatever, he's fine. I used to cover that song. I still do sometimes, but there's a song called Glory Bound and I was like, oh yeah, he did write Glory Bound. All right, I'll go. And then I met my wife at that show.
Mm-hmm.
There are these little blips, and I never would have done that if I didn't have that 4,000th of a second decision. Like, I woke up one day at 9:30 or whatever, and that was the sort of a dark time in my life. That was sort of around the donating blood plasma for ramen money kind of situation.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, I gotta change something. I gotta do something. I gotta get out, and that was it.
Mm-hmm.
And then,
are you still married?
Yes. Yeah, she's nice.
Good. That worked out good then.
Yeah. Yeah, everything's good.
Awesome. Should we play another should we play another song?
I guess.
Because I got a couple other ones here.
I don't know what you do here. Yeah, let's play another song. This one is it might be kind of a similar thing.
Let's see which one. I think I can go to my downloads and pick a song. How about There's That Man? How about this one?
Let's do that.
Tell me about That Man, but don't tell me as much as you tell me about the last one.
All right.
Make it quicker.
I'll keep it short.
I only need enough time to find the play button.
I'll keep it short. This one I wrote after...
Oh, wait, keep it going. I just lost the
song.
Go ahead.
Remember that song, the Crazy Heart? There's a song in... There's a movie called Crazy Heart with Jeff Bridges, who's a genius.
Yeah.
That's he sings a song on his back with an acoustic guitar.
Oh, no.
Oh, it's on the loose. You hit on sevens, nothing to lose.
Right.
Right? And it's just a sort of a four-chord kind of song. I saw that movie. I paused the movie at the end. I went into my sort of office-y space or whatever it was. And I wrote... just finger-picking on an acoustic... this next song didn't have a bridge yet, that came later, but the bones of the song were kind of stolen from the vibe of Jeff Bridges lying on his back writing a song,
cool,
you know, on an acoustic. And so that's how I wrote it, and then it turned into a, you know, four on the floor sort of.
Well, you know what, one of my favorite songs from that movie, I've quoted it so many times, it's such a clever line, but I guess songwriter was the producer. T-Bone Burnett, I think, wrote the line is, funny how falling feels like flying for a little while.
Oh,
come on. What a great line for a drunk.
That's so good.
And he's playing this drunk singer-songwriter.
So
and that's
good.
One of his big hits in the movie.
Right.
Funny how falling feels like flying for a little while. For about 6 feet. It's like a hilarious line. I just loved that line.
Yeah.
Because in that moment, the freedom you feel as you're falling, like,
right. Well, that's like the old line, like, it's not the fall that kills you, it's the impact.
I get that. I totally get
that's
that.
That's a great line, though.
Cool, man.
T-Bone Burnett, oh my
yeah,
God,
he's awesome. Something special.
Yeah.
So let's play a little That Man from Vinyl Station here on the Auto D Show, where my guest is Matthew Thornton. Check it out.
Look kind of funny. You hold them in your teeth like a dark god above you. You're underneath his feet. You're speaking every word like eyes across the page. Like someone else will hold you up with some old fashioned. That man.
And that's That Man here on the Auto D Show from Vinyl Station, where my guest has been Matthew Thornton, singer and songwriter of the band. Nice track.
Thanks, man.
This is another massive production. A lot going on.
It's a whole situation, isn't it?
So who's the drummer on that track?
That on that one was a guy called Jerry Rowe, who is a Nashville cat.
He's getting after it.
Oh, he was
on that tune.
He was amazing. We ended up working with a few guys from Nashville that were just incredible. I mean, the bass player, guitars, keys, all these guys, like, they're just monster players. And I think they had a lot of fun. Not that they necessarily told me that a lot, because, you know, they could be just being nice or whatever, but I think it was really fun because it was something that was so different. And the songs were, they needed them. I like writing songs that need a band and that need production and stuff. Mm-hmm. There are a few here and there that I'll write that don't need anything, that I could play it on an acoustic or on a piano and it's right. Good. I don't really like those kind of songs that much because I like the collaboration. That's why I never wanted it to be just my name, or I want to be in a band. And right. I like what other people bring to it, and that collaboration is always really amazing for me. And
well, I felt on that track, for example, the drums, it could have been a straight four thing that most guys would have just played, and he so sounds like a horse running with it.
Right.
It's really,
and does these weird
aggressive
weird fills, and then on the,
but it fits wonderfully.
Like, he's doing weird. Yeah, he's a really, really interesting drummer. I think he was on tour with Emmylou Harris when he was like 17 or 18 or something. And then he's just been like, he's in a almost like a punk metal band with his wife, like almost really? like where they can't play sets that are longer than 30 minutes because he can't eat that many carbs. Like, that's kind of like he's, it's like an athletic experience to like see his, but he's just just amazing.
Now, you mentioned being in Nashville, where I guess this record was cut.
Yeah.
Did you spend any more time there, or strictly just going in for the record and out again?
We were there for 3 days.
That's pretty much in and out.
We did one day where we showed them the songs, and then one of them would write out the chart like the Nashville guys do. System, you know, I don't know how any of that works, which is probably why. Anyway. Let's not get into that. But I don't understand anything about music except what I like and that kind of thing. But they would write out the chart. They would go make copies. Everybody would get a, you know, thing, and then we would show us the next one. And then so we did.
Isn't that amazing to watch, though? That level of player knocked that off.
Oh my god! Couple hours. It was maybe 2 hours of that, and just hanging out, just, you know. They weren't even really doing much. We weren't doing much. We were just kind of, okay, here's another one. And then they would go, okay, is that how you want it? And then maybe work on the arrangement. Like, and the producer would go like, yeah, like between 18 and, you know, like, let's add 4 bars and do something. But it was all language I never understood. And then the next day we were in the studio in Starstruck, which is Reba's place, I think, or it was at the time. And amazing studio. Everybody was set up. Walk in, and the pace was fast, but it was also, it was relaxed. And after the first day, I was like, it's very productive, but I was also like, we could be more productive.
Can we chew on this a little?
We could get a whole album done.
Right.
And instead, we got 6 songs done in 2 days.
Right.
Which is a lot, but all, like, there were like hour and a half lunches and like all kinds of stuff. Like, I was like,
well,
we could do more.
Reunion Scale, which is paid by the session, which is 3 hours, and they'll do 2 sessions a day typically.
Right.
They won't give you more songs than that for that money. So they're just not going to work harder.
Oh, maybe that was it.
They can crank them out, but you have to, right. You have to up front tell them, okay, we're paying you more than scale.
I was like, man,
then they'll do it.
We're already paid. Like, we're already plugged in. Let's do another one. Yeah.
Because they have to kind of have a process. Otherwise, people feel ripped off who don't get something. Somebody else
who
got
don't get the thing.
So here's what we get done. Here's how we
do it. It was super nice. We actually did do one extra song because we were expecting to do two on the last day. And we got one more song done, which is called Revolution, which is a nice one to check out.
Very cool.
It's only on YouTube right now, but yeah.
Listen to
Thanks
that.
Thanks for having me, man.
End the show music already.
This is so fun.
This is the first show I've gone over an hour in forever.
It flew by.
So
I want to do another one.
I couldn't stop you, and we ran over. I'm like, I want to keep going.
I'm really sorry about that. I get a little chatty.
No, that's great, man. Hey, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
And we'll do this again. Take care.
Thanks.